Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello, and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is the Progeny. I'm here with the...
Proletariat.
The potato.
The potato.
The pineapple.
Head. Mr. Potato Head.
The professor is here, along with the...
Patriarch.
The patriarch.
Patriarch. I might start saying
patriarch. Paterfamilias.
Patriarch.
Patriarchal. Patriotism.
I'm always... What is that word?
But, you know, maybe we just need to write it down on a billboard.
Maybe I should go by the pilgrim instead.
How you doing, pilgrim?
I can remember pilgrim instead.
Yeah, it's like John Wayne.
It's an easier word.
Speaking of John Wayne, I don't know if there are any David Copperfield fans out there, but I just finished David Copperfield. The Patriarch is still working on it, but I just learned from my friend Gina D'Alfonso at Dickens Blog that John Wayne, whenever he would sign a contract, would quote David Copperfield, the book, and quote one of the characters and say, "Barkis is willing." Which I just think is hilarious. And you're going to have to give us your John Wayne as Barkis impersonation.
Barkis is willing.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Anyway, maybe we ought to just take that.
He could have said recalled to life.
I guess he could have. Anyway, I just really enjoy that. Okay, well... Welcome back to the Pilgrims Podcast. We do have a few comments from last week. First of all, the Patriarch's presidential career is now in the tank.
No, it's not.
It is over because you can't run as the only engineering president anymore. Darryl has ruined your chances because Herbert Hoover was a mining engineer.
You know, Darryl might be my VP pick.
If he would just... keep quiet about that whole Hoover thing.
Well, we need to find out what occupation Darryl has, you know, if he's like... Do we know what occupation Darryl has?
I'm not really sure.
Probably... I don't know. I've got to be careful there. Probably something really cerebral. Cerebral.
Man.
Maybe
you're really on a roll tonight.
But, It's either him or Hillary Clinton. And I'll tell you what.
Your VP?
Yes. I think we ought to go back to that. I think we ought to go back to that, you know, where whoever gets the most votes, you know, the Electoral College gets the presidency, and number two is the VP.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine some of these, the past 8 years, if Mitt Romney was the vice president?
Well, strictly speaking, I mean, the vice president can't do much.
I know, but nonetheless, I think it would be good for the country. I don't know, something to think about. I think it would be good for the country to have that bipartisan forced upon the highest level of our executive branch, because they would have to be involved in some things. They would have to be involved in security decisions. Yeah, and they would have to get along. You know, can you imagine, you know, Bush and Clinton, you know, being in the same White House, and
apparently they're pretty good.
Even Kerry, you know, John Kerry and Bush, and you know, I think it would be interesting. I think it would be good for the country in some levels.
It'd be interesting.
And then, you know, you could send Hillary out for, like, coffee and, you know, could you bring us some water, please? Make me a cheese sandwich.
I'm sure she would love that.
You know, I'm going to have to cut this part out.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I was thinking, though, that since you can't run as the only engineer, I was thinking that maybe you could be like the only president with a history in rap, you know.
Yeah.
But then there's a problem with that. You want to tell us what that is? Or at least you're going to have stiff competition there.
My man, Marco.
Marco Rubio.
He's a rap master, jam dude, fella.
I can tell your rap career is going well so far. He's good at that whole improvisation thing.
I have to start wearing my ball hat backwards.
Now, where did you find out about Marco Rubio's rap?
Well, I heard that a while back, is that he, when he got would get ready for debates or something, then he would have all this just really, let's say, youthful music on his iPod, you know, and then I saw this clip today where TMZ trucked him down outside an airport, and they asked him a couple questions, and then they asked him about his music, and he started rattling off these names of these groups and these guys that I had no clue who they are, and I still don't know, but you know, you could see it in my imagination anyway, that with the interviewer saying, I didn't see that coming, you know. And you, because it was TMZ, and it was, you know, they're kind of into the gotcha celebrity type stuff. And I just think they didn't see that coming. Maybe they did, but maybe that's why they asked the question. But I thought that was cool.
One day he'll be listening to J.L.
He might be listening to J.L. I might just kick off my hip-hop career, you know. I could, you know, it's either that or the presidency.
Yep. I mean, that's... Maybe you could open for our band, which is... I'm in a band called Second Breakfast.
No, that's a terrible name for a band.
I think it's great. I mean, could it be worse than, what was it, Toad in the Wet Sprocket?
The name for my band that I always, you know... If I was going to have a band, you know, did I tell you what it was going to be? Truth in Advertising.
Oh, yeah.
Or now that I think about it, it could also be Truth to Power. But I think it'd be Truth in Advertising.
Truth to Power sounds too pretentious.
Well, you know. And then if you're going to do a name like Truth to Power, then you got to have all these lyrics that talk about Truth to Power.
So you got to have, you know, worthwhile lyrics.
If it's Truth in Advertising, then you can... Lyrics can be about anything you want. Puppies and kittens and... You know,
you can't
young love dying.
Yeah, you can't have a Truth to Power band that sings about puppies.
Young love dying is always a good place to go if you're gonna.
Exhibit A, the reaction of all teenage girls to the scene where in Les Mis, where all the Barricade Boys, well, make their exit.
By the farm.
Yes, by the.
Barricade.
By the barricade. And,
well,
you know, hear the people sing.
Yeah, well, they don't like that. They like that, then?
No, they just melt into a puddle. It's,
really?
It's, yes, that the entire Tumblr Les Mis fandom is obsessed with the Barricade Boys.
I'm more like, you know, we couldn't kill them off fast enough.
Yeah, well, as we've been over...
Why? Because they're pretty boys.
Yeah.
Except for Marius. Marius looks like he's kind of been run over by a truck or something.
Well, I've got a blog post that's upcoming.
At least his hair does.
That's upcoming, which is about
hair.
Pretty boys in movies. And
oh, really?
It is, yeah. Except I call them punks. The punk. Now, my brother is kind of obsessed with that at the moment. He calls them rogues. It is his number one topic of conversation. He sees somebody walking along the street with his baseball cap turned to the side, and he's like, "Bet that guy's a rogue."
Could be me. It could be me.
Yeah, that's possible, you know, because his definition of roguedom is very, very broad, and it pretty much includes everybody he doesn't like.
We're going to have a guest on here soon.
Yeah, we are.
We've contacted an old college buddy who's my arch nemesis.
We ought to
we're going to have him on.
Yeah, he needs he needs to have opening music because that would be awesome.
Yeah, it would be.
Actually, we all need opening music. We discovered what the Patriarchs.
Something from Mr. Bean, probably.
We discovered what the Patriarchs theme song was earlier today.
What is it?
No,
it's not out of here.
Jeeves and Worcester fans may appreciate that one.
No, it's not.
Well, what is your theme music? If there was a song, if there was
something from Christmas,
if there was a song that would play every time you walked into the room, what would it be?
Well, it'd be one of those things like how I see me, you know, how my mom sees me, how my wife sees me, and then you know how I see myself. That kind of how I see myself. It would be like the where. Kenneth Branham's delivering the St. Crispin, the Crispin Days speech, and that music in the background, that's me, and that's all about me, you know, that really gets to the heart of me, that's what me is all about.
Yes, and that would be your
Lisa
political campaign.
It would be like the Muppet Show or something whenever I walk into her room. The Matriarch, when, you know, she would say.
What about Mamaw?
Some battle hymn of the Republic, maybe, or, you know.
Yeah.
No, it would be more like, Mama, I can do no wrong in my mother's eyes. So it would be, you know, it would be something angelic. It may be like...
like when Arwen comes on the...
Well, no. I'm thinking Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Hallelujah, of course. I don't know. And then, you know...
That's actually really accurate.
And then, you know, you, when I walk into the room, what music do you hear?
Let's see.
Something hip-hop.
Yeah, perhaps. It would be something like that. It's like
Taylor Swift, maybe.
Possibly. Shake It Off, you know, our...
Yeah.
That's kind of your theme song.
It is.
Hmm.
I think she's a marketing genius. I think she's...
She has endeared herself to pretty much everybody.
She has, yeah.
Well,
it's pretty amazing.
I'll have to think about it. I will have to think about your theme song. One does not immediately spring to mind, but I'm sure that one will.
And then we'll have to ask Daryl what he thinks.
Yeah,
what
well,
he hears
in fact,
when I come on.
In fact, I want the entire
podcast.
No, I'd have to think about that one. But that's an open, you know, all our listeners need to
comment section is now open,
including our upcoming guest and of course Tacitus, if Tacitus is still out there, talking about, you know, well, they didn't have table manners in ancient Rome, as he was telling me earlier today when I was saying, oh, come on. Anyway, I guess we'd better get to our comments. Oh, yeah, we got to one comment. We're on comment number two now, and that's from Yankee Gospel Girl. And she wants to correct me. She says that the William Goldman, who wrote the review of Saving Private Ryan that we were talking about, it was William Goldman, not William Golding. So it was the Princess Bride guy, not the Lord of the Flies guy. To which I say, well, you know, what's the difference? I mean, Lord of the Flies, Princess Bride... You know, get kind of the same genre. Right?
No.
No, not really. Okay. Well, okay, that's probably a pretty good distinction to make, so thank you. I guess we'll...
They have the same initials, though.
Well, yeah, and then Golding, Goldman, you know. I can be forgiven for that. Okay, well...
Goldstein, Goldberg...
Yeah, you know, gold.
Goldman.
Gold. Well.
Goldilocks.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I wanted to start out by covering some movie news. There have been two major trailers released over this last week. And the Pilgrims podcast actually might be going to the movies in the future, you know, for the first time ever. We might go see The Avengers.
And we'll sneak in our own pod.
We might just, because we're cheap.
We're frugal.
You're awkward. That's it. Yeah. Well, the first of those trailers was.
But I did send him. I did send a campaign contribution to Marco Rubio. Thought it had to be done.
Well, there you have it. The Pilgrims Podcast has officially endorsed a candidate now.
Yeah. I hope I made the right decision. I like Scott Walker too, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I like a lot of the guys.
I like Rubio though, because he's really just very personal.
If you haven't seen,
he's just so fresh.
If you haven't seen the state of his farewell address to the State House when he was Speaker of the House in Florida, please go watch that. It's about, I don't know, it's 5 minutes long, and it's just priceless. It's absolutely brilliant. I love it. When I saw that the first time, I was just blown away, and I thought, man, that guy will be president. And even if he is 7 years younger than me, you know.
He does.
He might call me to be his VP.
He looks like he's about 30.
I know.
I mean.
But he's not.
He's not.
No. I don't know.
Was he older than JFK?
Yeah.
JFK was like the youngest.
I think so. I think you got to be 35. And I don't know how old Kennedy was, but he may have been 40-ish. You know, he was young. He had very young children.
Yeah.
So, you know, could have been early 40s.
Well, the first thing we're going to talk about is this new Star Wars trailer. There's already been a teaser released, which was about, you know, something like 30 seconds, or maybe, actually, it might have been a minute. That saw bits and pieces of it. You know, you didn't see too much. You saw John Boyega as a stormtrooper and somebody, you know, on a speeder going across the desert and a cool looking new droid. But now we've got a second trailer, which is much more detailed. What is your reaction to that? If you had to summarize your expectations based on that trailer in one sentence. Tacitus gave you some words last night.
Well, yeah, but I think, I don't know, I mean, because I don't want to get,
I'm giving you an opening for the great line there.
Well, I don't remember what it was, but
Tacitus said.
Well, but we were talking about. I mean, you're talking about the movie. I think you want me to ask about the trailer or the movie?
I don't know. You know.
Well, I mean, I thought it was okay. I like the big Hulkin Imperial cruiser or whatever buried in the sand there. I thought that was cool. That'd be neat to go over and walk around in. But.
Spoiler alert! It isn't real.
Well, I don't know. But
though I'll tell you what is real, that droid with the little head that floats above it, that's a real thing.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
I mean, it's not CGI.
I'm not surprised.
It's amazing.
They got unlimited.
I know, here. But it's cool.
And I just really didn't like the Sam Gamgee line at the end there with, you know, hoop it up, Bob, let's go, Chewie. And, it's like I was telling you last night, it's also like, let's get the groceries out of the back of the Falcon. Take them in here, put them away in the refrigerator.
Try and do the Kessel Run.
Watch a game this evening. Me and you, buddy.
These days we can only do the Kessel Run in about 3 parsecs.
I just thought, and what was it he said he should have said instead?
I've got a bad feeling about
that. Yeah, that would have been much better.
I figured that might have been your general impression about the movie itself.
No.
No?
I mean, I don't lay awake at night like apparently lots of people in the United States are friend that we just watched on the little video.
There's a really cute video of a fella named Father Roderick watches the Star Wars trailer, and he's filming his reaction to the Star Wars trailer, and I just think that there's a lovely lack of cynicism, and he's just, you know, bringing out the 8-year-old in him.
Lack of reality.
Well, you know, I have a feeling
that
90% of the rest of his life isn't spent goofballing around about Star Wars. I mean, some people it is.
But this draws it into question. I mean, you know, if you get so spun up over and he's seriously spun up over a Star Wars trailer that's 2 minutes long, that, you know, to react to it the way he did, it makes you wonder, okay, where do you come down on some of these other issues in life? And maybe that's not fair, but I just don't get it. I don't get it. But, you know, I don't get a lot. I don't get NASCAR guys that get in RVs and travel around all summer long from NASCAR venue to NASCAR venue, spending what has to be thousands of dollars to watch guys drive around in a circle. I mean,
well,
I don't get that either.
There's kind of a difference between somebody spending millions of dollars to go and do something, or somebody sitting down and enjoying geeking out about reliving their childhood, you know, and kind of. I don't know. I mean, I don't have as much of a nostalgic connection to Star Wars as some other movies because my love for Star Wars was cut short tragically, you know, about halfway through when you're like, you know, Mark Hamill is a terrible actor.
Who said that to you?
Somebody very cruel and intent on trampling my childlike sense of wonder, whoever it was.
Welcome to the real world, kid.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I've never been able to enjoy Star Wars as much since then. And that person has you know.
Well,
so, and look, you know, I mean,
I was just opening your eyes to what to what the inevitable was. I mean,
well, it's kind of like saying, okay, you know, I loved A Room with a View, and I thought that it was a lovely and innocent kind of fairy tale romance type thing. And then you were over there and you're like, people are dying in China. And I'm like, okay, you know, a dose of reality is okay, but, you know, I just think that there is a place to...
Did I say that?
No, but that was the gist of your...
Oh.
What you actually said was, Daniel Day-Lewis plays an absolute idiot in this movie. I can't believe you like this. This is so sappy and predictable. and I'm just sitting over there and I'm like, it's romantic. And you're like, romance is for dummies.
I didn't say that.
No, but, you know.
Poor romance is for dummies, maybe. poorly executed romance.
Well, maybe we will do a Room with a View for our podcast someday, and you can make fun of it on there.
And then maybe we could do romantic movies.
Okay, well, yeah, well, what's your favorite romantic movie? Oh, yeah. Because you don't watch them.
Well, Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
That's an easy one. But, you know, that's a good question.
But that's more a comedy of manners than anything else. I mean, the romance works and everything, but as, you know, it's much, a much more intellectual experience than it is kind of a much more basic mythological type thing. And I would say the same thing about Star Wars, actually, is that it taps into...
You know, go ahead, I'm sorry.
And this is something that I think that... maybe it's just that I'm younger and... hardened, you know, or I'm just, you know, I do want to have the ability to appreciate something that has an innocence and a basic appeal to it. Star Wars is about a farm boy who goes and fights the evil empire and ends up with the princess, except, of course, he doesn't end up with the princess, but then the roguish, the smuggler, then there's the smuggler, you know, but you just know he's going to be redeemed in the end, and and the big battles in space and music and, you know, it's in good versus evil.
There's no music in, or no sound in space.
That is it. That's the essential difference between you and me is that I'm sitting there thinking, wow, this is great and big and exciting and everything, and you're like, there's no sound in space. You just it doesn't have to be quite.
But somewhere along the way that changed. I mean, I wasn't always like this. But getting back to romance, is that there needs to be a movie. I think the problem with that is that the problem with that genre is that they always set it up so that there's this tension, right, of some type.
Mm-hmm.
Between the guy and the girl, and then at the very end of the movie, that gets resolved and they get together and live happily ever after.
Yeah.
There needs to be, and it's probably out there, but there needs to be a movie where you buy in early. You buy in early that these two are together and that it's a big deal. And then they either get separated or they get challenged somehow. And they're fearlessly and, you know,
they're determined to be together.
Determined to be together. And I don't want any of this baloney where, you know, that she's weak this way or that he's a jerk this way or whatever. You know, don't give me that. Is that would be a really good movie? Is it that they? It's almost like, you know, you're talking about Han Solo taking on the Empire, is that they're not going to let anything get between them, you know. That would be a good romantic movie. And then at the end, you know, the end could end in any number of different ways, but and if somebody writes in here and says that The Notebook does that, no, thank you. And that doesn't even... I made the mistake of watching that once or sitting.
The Patriarch does not like Nicholas Sparks unless it's A Walk to Remember.
Well, that,
or was it?
That,
or was it Remember Me? You know, like one of those things. Because you watched
it. It was pretty good.
I heard somebody the other day talking about Nicholas Sparks movies, and they said that every single one, every cover, you know, and this goes for pretty much all romantic movies, all the covers are of white people almost kissing.
Yeah, and it's like, funny. And you know, and that one, from what I remember, Walk to Remember, is it had, you know, those weaknesses, and I understand why they put that in there, and that's all well and good, but I want to see some strength, I want to see some, you know, depth of feeling,
well,
and that love is absolutely, you know, that there's an absolute dedication. That would be cool. I think that'd be fun. I need to write that, maybe. So I'm going to call it...
That just sounds like a lot of movies I've seen.
No, it doesn't. You can't name one movie that...
Well, I mean, like, there are tons of movies where the couple, from the instant you walk onto the screen, you know that these people are fated to be together because they're the two lead actors, you know, in the movie, and you're like, okay, well, obviously they're going to be together. And that's one of the neat things that over the last 2 or 3 weeks of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., for those of you who have been watching it, there were several character pairings that I automatically assumed because from the beginning of the show that they would be together, and then suddenly this has all changed.
But it's all about getting them together. I'm talking about...
Starting with them together. And then they're separated.
Well, no.
And then they have
But they have something that challenges them, you know.
But they
face it together instead of... It makes it stronger.
Well, what you're saying is you don't want a story in which somebody meets and then get together. You want a story about a marriage.
Okay. What I want is I want the movie after they've met.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Because the happily ever after ain't gonna happen.
Yeah, and I could list a few movies like that, but tell you what. Well, I will. But tell you what.
Godfather.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah, they got along good, too. Yeah.
It went along explosively for Michael and Apollonia.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, well, we'll tell you what. We'll talk about this next week. We'll do a romantic movies podcast next week. You want to do that?
No.
Why not?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know why not. But I guess we will. Because you're the slave driver here.
Oh yeah, it's a you know.
We'll bring in the matriarch for some special.
That's
counsel.
True because the matriarch is an expert. Next, on the trailer side of things, we have a new Batman versus Superman trailer coming out. Now,
what's it about?
Okay. You're the comic book guy. I was never really into the comic books, but you have kind of a history there. Now, as an expert, as somebody who spent much of his childhood, you know, reading about superheroes, what did you think of that trailer?
Well, I thought it was I'm not going to see it, of course, because Ben Affleck's in it. So I can't go see it. But if you lay that aside, I thought it looked cool. But so did the Superman trailer. The Superman trailer looked cool too, but we all know how that turned out.
Yeah.
And so
they took like the two cool shots in the movie and then they used them with some cool music.
But there was a graphic novel probably back in the 90s from Frank Miller. I think it's called The Dark Knight, and it was really, really good. Because it brought together a lot of the characters from Batman, and the last chapter of that particular graphic novel was kind of Batman and Superman going mano a mano, and it was really cool. And there were a couple threads in that particular graphic novel that I never think they really brought to bear or to fruition in their Batman series. But if they had...
Christopher Nolan's.
Yeah, if they had... I mean, there may have been some, but it was cool. I mean, that was... Because in the graphic novel, Batman's an old guy. I mean, he's kind of over the hill, and he's, you know, the whole town's going downhill fast, and he's got to kind of come back and pull it out of the fire, and he doesn't. And but in the, you know, he's kind of tagged as a vigilante or the vigilante, and you know, Superman is tagged to bring him in and that kind of thing. And so it was, you know.
Well, I mean, the thing about it for me is that.
But it looked good. It looked promising. Anything with false gods strewn across the chest of the.
Kind of a big Superman thing.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, well, I thought that was interesting because the Man of Steel movie, just to a gratuitous, they were always using Christ metaphors for Superman, and there was no subtlety about it whatsoever. It was kind of hilarious by the end of it, you know, he's sitting there in a church, and behind him there's this stained glass window with light coming through, and you're just like, come on, can it be? and then, you know, his final act of saving the world is by killing somebody by snapping their neck, you know, so it was just kind of perverse. So seeing that kind of turned on its head and questioned some is at least kind of a welcome thing. Now, on the other hand, I'm firmly in the camp of thinking that, I mean, do we really need another Batman movie just a few years after The Dark Knight Rises? I think it's going to be very difficult to impress anybody after that. The other thing is that that whole genre of movies, they've gone so dark that...
Well, they can... I mean, but if they pull that out from the Frank Miller graphic novel, it'll have some teeth to it. And I think it... You know, they had they showed the cowl, you know, there, and the kind of the new...
Cowl?
You know, the cape.
Cowl.
C-O-W-L.
Like a monk thing.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was like with the overhead light coming down on it. And if you look at it, it was a different design. The ears are more laid back. It's more like a pit bull, you know. And little things like that, you know, can make a big difference in it. And I mean, I don't. In other words, I don't look for it to become Pee Wee Herman, but it's going to be a lot more. It's going to. I mean, it'd probably be a pretty fun movie to watch.
Hmm. I've just got an image now in my head of the Bat Cow.
Yeah, go back and look at the movie. Go back and look at that trailer, and that's the first thing I noticed, is that it's a different design.
Yeah. I noticed though that the Batmobile looked like it was basically the same design.
Maybe,
as in the Nolan movies.
Oh, hard to beat that.
That's true. And Jeremy Irons is signed on as Alfred, so.
Hmm.
That ought to be interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be very different from Michael Caine.
Yes, and probably in the right direction.
Okay. Well, today. Well, actually, before we get into this, there's been a little bit of delay in between recording bits of this podcast, but we just learned over Facebook that Jonathan Crombie passed away. He was best known for playing Gilbert Blythe in the 1985 TV film Anne of Green Gables, which was really kind of a staple of my childhood. He was just that whole series. It's something that's incredibly nostalgic to watch. I rewatched it with my little sister who had never seen it and my grandmother who had never seen it, like two or three months ago. And just, man, you know, that whole thing just packs a huge punch of nostalgia. And, after watching it, I ended up looking up him and Megan Follows on Facebook and Twitter, trying to find them. And I ended up following him on Twitter, I think, you know, so it's just odd timing for me. So, you know, it's just sobering news. He was 48.
Man knows not his time. Talk about a romantic. That was well done. The whole Gilbert Blythe and Anne of Green Gables thing.
Yeah, that
it was kind of well done. They fumbled the ball at the end, like so many seem to do. It didn't make sense.
You mean the third movie?
No, when Gilbert gets sick.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, he's sick apparently for, like, all summer long, and she never goes to see him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really? You know? And, that just didn't, I mean...
That was a little contrived.
Yeah, it was, I mean, if she loved him as much as they were leading you to believe that she did, then she would have been over there every day, you know? But instead, he just kind of saunters up, you know, oh, I made it. I lived. And she's kind of like, oh. Yeah, that's good. And no, look, you're getting married, you know. And it didn't. That was the only thing. Other than that, it was hard to find anything much wrong with that because it was just a really well written, well directed, well acted.
Yeah, it's it was really extraordinary. We might talk a little bit about it and kind of the archetypes in that next week. In the meantime, we have finally gotten to...
What's the difference in an archetype and a stereotype?
A stereotyped image can obliterate a man's own experience.
Archetype and a stereotype?
Yep.
Well, an archetype is something, basically a mythic form of something that turns up all the time. You know, a stereotype is generally more of a negative thing, something that's less, more petty, I guess. Anyway. Well, we've finally gotten to our topic tonight, which is movie music. And I'm not really an expert on this, so we'll kind of see how this goes.
So Democrats would be able to use the word stereotype, but they, when they want to talk about something bad about Republicans, they'd use the word archetype when they want to use the good version of it. Right? Because it's basically the same thing.
Sort of. I mean, an archetype is... is not generally used in conversation because it's more of kind of a literary term.
That Mitt Romney, he's a stereotypical big corporate guy. Anyway, I'm sorry. So we're talking about music?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about...
You know, I hear that the hills are alive with the sound of music.
Yeah, yep, yep.
That's what they say.
I'm going to start out with a little bit of history here. I've taken some quotes from various websites here. The use of original film scores dates back to the early 1900s when silent movies first began. And due to the loud and noisy film projectors, as well as audience members, I'm sure, music was used to cover the distracting noises. Often, in-house instrumentalists like pianists, organists, and sometimes even orchestras performed improvised music using cue sheets to help guide the musician through the movie. As movies evolved to include sound, Hollywood began hiring composers to create original film scores. However, it wasn't until the early 70s when consumers could purchase some of the original film scores. In 1972, Charles Gerhard convinced record label RCA to record and release a series called Classic Film Scores, which instantly became a hit, and the rest is, as you say, history. Now, it was in the 30s that, after kind of a few years of experimentation, scoring film soundtracks became an art. The first movie with sound was The Jazz Singer in 1927, but, you know, now that they had talkies, they were starting to figure out the different things they could do, and of course, you wouldn't have, with a talkie, you wouldn't have an orchestra there, you know, performing it, you'd do something else, and, scoring film soundtracks became an art in earnest thanks to a small group of foreign-born musicians. First and foremost, two Austrian-born and classically trained composers. Erich Wolfgang Korngold's coined a lush, overwhelming operatic style with Michael Curtiz's Captain Blood in 1935, and especially The Adventures of Robin Hood and the Seahawk, as well as Charles Gerhard's Anthony Adverse and Sam Wood's King's Row. So you had something kind of really basic there in the 30s, which was kind of a more orchestral soundtrack, and you didn't really get much variation from that. Now in the 40s, you kind of got a little bit of change there. So to take a break briefly from the history lesson, what would you say your favorite film score is of all time? If you wanted, you could narrow it down to genre, I suppose.
Well, I mean, the problem... Well, that's obviously very subjective, right?
Oh, yeah. But, you know.
And it's also, you know, even though there's maybe, like, one piece in the movie that you really, really, really liked, and you don't pay that much attention to the rest of it, and you think, well, you know. But for example, Chariots of Fire, you know, the main theme is really cool, but some of the other stuff's a little weird.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to quite fit, but nonetheless, it's good stuff. That's Mr. Vangelis. Anyway, and
Vangelis.
So I don't know. I would have to say that Empire of the Sun is way up there, you know, because it's got such beautiful music all the way through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very iconic. Is that the right word? That very, you know, at least for me. That it, you know, it when I hear, you were listening to some of that earlier in the other room, and just as it went through the different pieces, it just all came back. You know, it's all the kind of the feelings of what they were trying to get across.
It's very evocative.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
That is a good word.
And it's a very John Williams-y score.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a, and with, I guess, a few exceptions, he's a very varied composer. He does all sorts of different things, but there's kind of this John Williams stamp on it.
Yes.
Just kind of a...
Schindler's List is a lot different than that, but
yeah, that's true.
But it's still, when you listen to it, you think, yeah, I could see Williams putting that together. And he did. So.
Yeah, he was, I mean, throughout the 40s and 50s, you really had the jazz starting to come in, and some of those influences instead of the more orchestral stuff. And in the 60s and 70s, they really focused, there was a big feel and trend in film scoring for jazz and popular music scores. That was all the rage. And then John Williams kind of comes back, you know, and he brings back the orchestral score, but he brings it back with a vengeance, you know, and it's... And he, you know, he's kind of been the king of Hollywood ever since.
I guess Empire Strikes Back was the first album I ever bought.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah. And it was like maybe the two album set, and you opened it up and it had all the pictures inside, and it was just...
That's cool.
It was cool. Yeah. If I'd never opened it, probably be worth, you know, $2,500 or something today. Who knows? But, and who knows where it is. But, you know, good music can make a movie. Do you think it can make a bad movie good, or can it make a good movie bad? Does it take it up a notch, or how important is it?
Yeah, I mean, it depends really on the movie. Different movies require different things. Some movies, I think, do very well with a very, very minimal soundtrack, or even none at all, you know, like Into Great Silence, which, of course, that's kind of the point.
And Orbit didn't have much.
Yeah, and what it had was, you know...
Real simple.
Very simple.
So what's your favorite?
Well, I know that this one is... I mean, I would probably say that the soundtrack I've listened to the most would
be... Mr. Bean's Holiday.
That's close second. But, obviously, we're going with the Muppet movie here. And, I'm kidding, Dad. Don't give me that look. The soundtrack I've listened to the most would be The Lord of the Rings by Howard Shore. Now, as I've gotten older, I probably don't find it as complicated or as good as I used to. I don't know. But it just... I just loved it. There was so much there. You had the Rohan theme, which was really kind of more rustic. You had the pounding Uruk Hai. You had the...
yeah, he did a good job of that.
The kind of ethereal Enya stuff for the elves and the sort of Irish jig for the hobbits.
He got
the Gondorian theme. It was just great.
He gets an A for that. Not an A plus, but he gets an A. I mean, because it was very well done.
Yeah, it's very well done. His orchestration isn't always great because, I mean, you have three there's a process of scoring the film. The first part is spotting, in which you go in and kind of look at the cues and get all that stuff ready, you know, and then writing, and then orchestration. And his orchestration can just be kind of over the top. Like, I was thinking in The Hobbit, the moment at the end of the first movie, when Thorin and Bilbo were there, and, you know, Bilbo says something heroic, and then immediately Howard Shore has to punctuate it with music. And I'm just like, oh, did you have to just hold it back a little bit? You know, he doesn't have as much restraint, I think, as some other filmmakers. Or, I mean, film composers, I don't know. He also did Silence of the Lambs, though.
Hmm.
And
Braveheart, right? No, he didn't.
No, that was
Horner.
Yeah, and Horner, I'm torn about because I like some of his work, but he's very repetitive sometimes. He will take pieces of his music and kind of switch them around and put them in different places, like in his soundtrack for The New World. Oh, wait a minute, I forgot about The New World. The New World soundtrack is gorgeous. I love it. It's amazing.
And it's Horner?
Yes. Though, admittedly, not too much of it got into the movie because Terrence Malick decided to use a whole bunch of Wagner instead. I mean, he was going all Morse on the guy. And he checked out the soundtrack. He's like, oh, that's nice. I'm going to use Das Rheingold. Rheingold. And, you know, so that's what he did. And, you know, he actually made a movie. I think it was in the 90s. And, like, George Clooney was in it or somebody. And George Clooney had a pretty significant part, but he ended up getting cut out of the movie and not being told about it. Or, you know, some actor, I can't remember which actor it was, but he was supposed to be the main character or something, you know, and he ended up cut out of the movie, which is such a Terrence Malick thing to do.
It's good for him.
Yeah, I guess so, but I'd be a little bit ticked. Christopher Plummer got really mad at him because Malick had him, and he was in his 70s at this time, you know, had him climb up in a tree, you know, and he really didn't want to do this, but he climbed up in this tree and had to stand there for this shot, you know, and he had him do it, you know, and he just was really mad, and he's like, well, fine, you know, whatever, for art's sake. And then the scene was cut out of the final movie. And so Christopher Plummer has pretty much vowed that he will never, ever be in a Terrence Malick movie again. Yeah. Speaking of The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music.
Which he didn't sing, which he did not sing in.
Yeah, he didn't sing Edelweiss, speaking of film scores. I mean, that was like, when I found out that Christopher Plummer did not sing that his voice was dubbed, my childhood just kind of crumbled to pieces.
Loss of innocence.
It was all a lie.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I can never watch it innocently again and just think, man, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a trick. It's the same as, like, you know.
Hollywood does.
And Mark Hamill isn't a good actor either.
Well, we were watching Silverado earlier today, speaking of great movie music.
Yeah, the westerns really...
They kick it up a notch.
Yeah, the first western to really have a soundtrack that was kind of different from the other soundtrack, or, you know, something really iconic, was High Noon. And that was the first movie that had a theme song... that had a song that was nominated for an Oscar. I think it won the Oscar. Best Original Song. That wasn't a musical. It wasn't a musical. The theme song was nominated. So
that's interesting.
And it was the first movie to be promoted by its theme song, rather than vice versa.
That's truly some great music. That's very American music. And
just kind of the westerns,
yes,
in general. Yeah.
Yes, it's big sky music. And
yeah, and Silverado wasn't done by John Williams, but I can just see that influence everywhere in that.
Yeah,
that
and
score. It just really feels like one.
You know, when those guys are riding across the desert there or whatever, and the music's swelling in the background, and it's just, you know, I was just thinking, you know, okay, take that music out, and this whole scene is completely different. It's just, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. Four guys riding horses.
Yep.
You know. Yeah. Not even that. I mean, it's just, you know, so.
And that's what I think of. Well, what was that from? That was.
That's William Tell. That's from The Lone Ranger.
Oh. Well, there you go.
It's soundtracks. But it's the 1812 Overture, I think.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Well, speaking of that. A lot of these, you know, I was listening to Beethoven the other day, like you do, and I was thinking, you know, this just feels like I could just feel a lot of influences on movie soundtracks in Beethoven, or maybe it was Mozart or Bach even.
One of those old German guys.
Yeah, one of those old German guys. Who cares the difference, you know. I think it may have been Bach, come to think of it, but I can't remember. No, it was Beethoven. Okay.
There's a difference.
Yeah, I know. I just can't remember which piece it was. But I was listening to it, and I was thinking, you know, I bet that just sounded like something out of a John Williams piece or a Hans Zimmer piece. You know, and a lot of these guys have a lot of history in classical music, and especially the early. I mean, John Williams has written concertos.
Sure.
And as we were talking earlier, one of the pieces in Empire of the Sun is a Latin hymn that he wrote, or a choral piece, which is, I mean, it's in Latin, for goodness sake. So these are basically the modern Beethovens here. You know, if Beethoven were living now, he'd be doing the soundtrack to the next Transformers movie.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
I mean, I'm sure that there is a place for composers out there in this day and age, but most composers really end up in Hollywood these days. I think that that's kind of where they, or at least that's where the
that's
fame.
Where the money is.
Yeah, and that. There's
no doubt about that. But
yeah.
But yeah, because even the most mundane little, you know, TV shows have to have, and a lot of them, you know, have very, again, iconic. But think of Hawaii Five-0. Well, nobody thinks of any episode of Hawaii Five-0 that they might know Steve McGarrett and they might know some of the characters. I almost guarantee you they don't remember any of the episodes, but boy, they know that music. You know, they will know the music. And the same with like Gilligan's Island or some of the other 70s music that kind of were very catchy.
Yeah, of course, John Williams did the original Gilligan's Island soundtrack,
yeah,
which we've been over before, which is just kind of bizarre. Now, that piece didn't sound like a John Williams piece, I must say. That one I did not see coming.
And then, you know, thank goodness they're, you know, fate stepped in and wouldn't let the Beatles do their Lord of the Rings
thing. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it was fate and Tolkien, mostly. You know, Tolkien had actually been living in a neighborhood and been complaining about the neighbors who thought that they were the Beatles, he wrote. So we can thank his neighbors, but because they had a garage band that they were playing loudly. Though I would say this, that I don't think Tolkien would ever have allowed the Beatles to do it, regardless.
You can only hope.
And I think that they were trying to get who was the guy that did.
Although, you know, The Hobbit didn't turn out as planned either.
No, but we did get Fellowship of the Ring.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'd say that Elijah Wood does a little bit better than John Lennon as Frodo.
No doubt.
So, though I think that all the Beatles may have been living in a fantasy world.
I think that's a safe thing to say. Yes. It was a land called 1960s, which America now is still recovering from, because those people are now running the country. Let's see how that's working out.
Okay. Well.
But I was born in 1964, so, you know, I am not a child of the 60s, thank goodness, and I'm really not a child of the 70s. I prefer to be a child of the 80s.
I really love the soundtrack to Midnight Run. I think it's a terrific soundtrack.
I don't remember much about it.
And that's not a movie I'm necessarily recommending to folks, but it's got this great kind of retro soundtrack. It's kind of jazzy, kind of blues. It was by Danny Elfman, who's famous
He's
for.
He's done a lot.
Yeah, and this and he also did Edward Scissorhands. And this was a very, I think, atypical soundtrack for him. He actually sang the soundtrack for the credits, but I really enjoyed it. It's just a lot of fun. It really goes all sorts of places, just like the movie. It's very fun. It's got a little bit of an edge to it. It can be very poignant at times. It can be exciting. It can be it was a really nice example of its kind, and it can be really funny it too. It just really.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah.
Had some neat music.
Yeah, I don't remember too much about it except for the.
Kind of electronica stuff that's in it.
Well, I remember the diegetic music in it, which is the sound that is being generated by actions on the screen or actors singing. You know, non-diegetic sound would be the actual film score. But if an actor is on screen singing, then that doesn't really count. So I remember mostly in Ferris Bueller is the scene where he's in New York City and he's singing.
Chicago, Twist and Shout.
Yeah, Twist and Shout. Which was, of course, the kind of the big
song. You've got to get those. Boy, you're going to get some comments if you mess that one up. I'm just saying, Chicago. It's not New York.
Oh, is it?
Yes, that was where it takes place in Chicago.
Ah, well, they're all, you know, big big places with it's not like it's...
There goes our...
I mean, it's not like it's Rural Retreat, which it's not like it's Rural Retreat, which obviously everybody can tell the difference between Rural Retreat and Marion, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Virginia. the upper metro area of Rural Retreat.
Yep.
The bypass. Which is the same as the business route. You're one and the same.
Well, you've also got kind of the other big soundtrack composer who's really popular right now is Hans Zimmer.
Oh yeah.
Who's done a lot of different things. He did The Thin Red Line, which was Terrence Malick, and he did Gladiator. He did the Dark Knight trilogy. He did Inception. Did he do
Master and Commander?
No, that was I don't know who that was, though. That was mostly a classical soundtrack.
It was, but yeah, it was.
I really liked that as a thing, though.
I will say a real quick thing on Master and Commander. Remember when they got the camera's kind of like coming up from the water, and you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's got the drums going there. It's really good. That's a good center.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I think your sibling has that.
He does, yeah.
But sorry, you were talking about
Zimmer, he also did 12 Years a Slave. Now, my problem, and he did, I think my favorite of his was in fact a musical he did, which was The Prince of Egypt. He did The Prince of Egypt. Which is just a great soundtrack, and it's a great musical, and it's one of my favorite movies. Period. So,
I'll tell you a movie that, this came to my mind, and I think this is a movie that is a really good movie, but it could have been a great movie with great music, and that's Princess Bride. You think? From what I remember, the music in that is just completely predictable. It's completely blah.
Well.
And it's such a quirky movie that everybody likes and everybody loves the movie.
Well, the music
doesn't have really, really good music.
The music could have been better, but I like the fact that it is kind of just this typical fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, it's, thing. It's, I don't know. I mean, the soundtrack does not play a huge role in the movie.
But it could. That's what I'm saying. It could have. It could have been.
I mean, I remember like Buttercup's theme, which was kind of on the guitar, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember that. But
it's like As You Wish. Okay, that is totally not it. But I remember Buttercup's theme. That was pretty.
Well, I don't know. I just think it could have been. That's just came to my mind. I don't know.
Yeah.
As a movie that could have went from really good to really great. With some really, really good music.
Yeah, I remember seeing...
That would be fun. Like, I would like to do that. I would like to score a important movie event. They ought to ask me to do that. Somebody out there ought to ask me to do that.
You going to do a rap score?
Well, you know, I might work in a little bit of that.
It could be edgy. You'd get an Oscar for original song or something.
Well, I'll go over to Wayne Henderson's shop in Rugby, Virginia, and...
Oh, speaking of which, since we are who we are, we got to talk about the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Is, of course, their I mean, Racing Arizona kind of had a little bit of that in it. But our brother, Where Art Thou, really took bluegrass and put it center stage.
Whole time.
Even though it was taking place in a country which wasn't really the bluegrass area. The bluegrass is from our neck of the woods, which is Appalachia. So they kind of took that and transported it down to Mississippi or wherever that's supposed to be shot, filmed.
I heard somebody the other day on the radio talking about Appalachia. I was like, I wonder where that's at.
I think it's
talking about that those Appalachians, you know. it's not how you say it.
It's true.
It ain't how you say it.
It ain't. It ain't. It ain't.
Anyway, you were saying about the Coen Brothers.
Well, they really brought a kind of an Americana edge to it, which I really liked. A lot of those other things could be more of a classical thing, but I really liked the fact that they were bringing back bluegrass and making it just a central thing to a big and important score. And they've continued to do that. They did that with True Grit, though that was less bluegrass, and they kind of went to.
Well, technically, that's not bluegrass.
What would you call it then?
Old time. It is more old time country music than bluegrass. Bluegrass is like Ralph Stanley and with the, what they call the high lonesome, where the guy sings in the real high soprano kind of thing, and it's I don't know, the cadence of it is. There's a lot of fiddle. There is a scene in there is one scene in Old Brother Where Art Thou where, and it's something like, I think the name of the tune is something that got to do with Indians, and it's do 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 do. It may be when the Klansmen are doing their thing. I don't remember.
Really heavy orchestrate, or I mean instrumental stuff more.
Well,
than
maybe, but any rate. But, you know, Man of Constant Sorrow, to me, is more like old-time country music, which is more like the Carter Fold and what you get from a lot of heavy instrumental type stuff, like you get from Wayne Henderson and these guys around here, than the bluegrass. It's a little bit different, John. You get bluegrass is more like, to me, Kentucky, well, maybe West Virginia even. And we certainly have it around here too, but I think and I'm not an expert on it, and I think the aficionados that are out there would be able to kind of, they know it when they hear it. They know the difference when they hear it. And but that what they call a high lonesome is usually associated with bluegrass. So, but anyway, that Old Brother Where Art Thou, I think, is more on the old time, because it had Alison Krauss in it, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't associate her so much with bluegrass. Maybe I'm wrong. I may be wrong about that. But, and what's the other girl's name that sings in that? Jillian Welch, maybe? I'm not sure. But, you know, it's a cool soundtrack. I had a little bit of a problem with that movie, and it's kind of its treatment, you know, because that soundtrack was really well received, and it was really popular, and it won all these awards. May have won like a, you know, an Oscar or whatever the heck those things are for music. But at the same time, it kind of really belittled, you know, the Southern people a little bit. You know, and in my take on it was that they there's not a whole lot of good that comes out. You know, looking at those guys, and for those artists that participated in that, I wonder how they kind of justify that. Like if they think, oh well, it's a great movie, and you know, it's really very popular, and it, but yeah, okay, and all those things are true, and it was a fine movie for what it, you know, it was really funny, and it was well written, and all that good stuff, but it didn't paint. You know, if you had, I mean, it made Southern people look like complete fools most of the way through, did it not?
Yeah, I mean, you've got Mayberry on the one side, which kind of glamorizes and sugarcoats the South, and
yes, okay,
and which is pretty much the number one best, you know, most running TV show in history of the United States. But
in the South.
Well, no, I mean, I think it plays pretty much everywhere.
It may. We'll have to have our listeners chime in on that one too. But.
Well, I know that our friend Dan from California said that they watched it all the time.
Okay.
So. I would say I've been thinking about it ever since you kind of were talking about Oh Brother Where Art Thou, and I think that it is more important to make, if you want to humanize a particular subset of people, if you want to make those characters sympathetic, it is more important to make them interesting than to make them intelligent. Because, let me finish, because that's what Dickens did. He took the poor, and he took the people that were just kind of social outcasts, and he took them and he made them the most interesting person you ever have heard of. Now, oftentimes they were buffoons and pretentious and proud and everything, but you really wanted to interact with these people. Now, if you make somebody just kind of this paragon of virtue, most people aren't interested in them. I mean, you could talk about the South and how wonderful it is, but it's, I think it's more important if you're making a story to make something interesting and than it is to make it, to try and make some sort of paragon of it.
Then I will buy that argument, and I don't disagree with you. Then let's do that with everybody.
Sure.
Right. I wish they, then I will accept that argument. But I just wish we would do that with everybody then. Because so many people get so spun up about, you know, how certain people, don't you think?
Would you agree that a lot of people would watch Andy Griffith and look down on people in that show. Just, you know, the Andy Griffith guy, oh, he's kind of the small town sheriff and everything. But, you know, if you can't take the South for what it is, if you're going to try and take Southern characters and turn them into something they're not to make them appealing to other people.
No, yeah.
I mean, I just don't think you can.
No, I don't agree. That's why I say I agree with you.
I think that you're going to have to figure out a way to take what the South is and then reveal that it is, in fact, something interesting, something compelling, and something that, you know, that is very different from Northern culture, very different from all those things, but not necessarily what the stereotypes in Hollywood portray it as, you know.
Well,
you can get a much more nuanced portrayal of it than the Beverly Hillbillies, for instance.
Yeah, but all I'm saying is I think that if we're going to go that route, then that's not the way we treat, that's not the way everybody else gets treated. And so maybe that's okay, and I'm not going to make a big deal out of it.
I don't know, I mean, it,
but
have you seen, like, the latest Seth Rogen film? You know, it's just,
no, but I, you know, think about Midnight Run.
Yeah,
you know, how they portray those guys is, you know, I don't know. Maybe.
Well, like every character in that movie is a complete idiot, but you love them for it.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of lovable buffoons.
Yeah, so maybe I'm being over.
And I think it's interesting because that movie, there are people who act immorally throughout that whole movie, but I think because they're all idiots, you know, and because there are like two characters at the center of it who have this really, perhaps backward sense of morality. It is a very moral movie, so anyway.
So you can cut all that out. You can cut all that out I just talked about.
Well, actually, we better wrap it up, because I think we're over time. We recorded this in two or three different segments, so I have no idea how much time this has taken. Anyway, next week we're going to be talking about romantic movies.
Mm-hmm.
The Patriarch is excited. If you want to find us online, we're on Twitter. We have a Twitter page. We have the blog, of course, the Films Podcast blog. You can like us on Facebook. You can leave us a review on iTunes. That's how people find us. That would be terrific. We've got an RSS feed. We're all over the internet in different places. And the Patriarch has a blog, and I have a blog. Go ahead and check us out. So, in the meantime...
I don't have one.
Let's see. Matriarch, we need an ending line.
An ending line. We'll see you... Well, I don't know. I don't know. I'm trying to think of something musical. Like, Alvita Zane. So long, farewell.
Alvita Zane, goodbye.